This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 260, was recorded on February 25th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Abra Plata Resource Corporation, a premier emerging silver and gold exploration company. Ticker ABRA on the TSX Venture Exchange and ABBRF in the United States. In response to our call for a prominent deflationist to balance the recent series of inflationists, we received an overwhelming number of requests for Stephen Van Meter. To be honest, he wasn't even on our radar previously, but as the announcer says, Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. So we've got Stephen booked, and the deflationist that you're so waiting for is on the way, folks, really, but not this week. Lynn Alden returns as this week's feature interview guest, and no, she's not a deflationist. Lynn says we're in a policy transition from monetary dominance to fiscal dominance. Lynn will explain what that means before going on to discuss everything from inflation to the long-term debt cycle to broad money supply growth to gold and, yes, even Bitcoin. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart book is titled Markets Buzzing.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, volatility's back. Option expiration's behind us. All the gamma pins were lifted. And at least the intraday whips are definitely like double, triple of what we've been seeing in the prior weeks. And it really looks like this market might potentially be in some sort of a correction. What's your take on all of this?
Well, I agree with you. Certainly, volatility has picked up. And of course, as we've been talking about for the last several weeks, there's lots of really smart people saying, hey, valuations are stretched. This could be it. Get ready for a blow-off top here. You know, it could be a really big downside. And I think that's a very real possibility. But frankly, I also think it's possible that the tail risk on the other side for a melt-up as a result of a crack-up boom is possible too. What this really speaks to in my mind, Patrick, is I don't want to just be in the stock market with a simple long position. If I'm going to participate in the equity market at all, I'd want to be considering one of the long volatility strategies that Chris Cole has talked about, and I know that you specialize in at Big Picture Trading. So let's come back to this in the post-game segment and talk about, you know, because I think there's plenty of room to expect maybe this is about to be a big move in one direction or the other, but I sure don't want to be just, you know, buy and hold for the long term in this market.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar, because the U.S. dollar, temporarily at least, was trading below the 90 level. It's been pretty weak for the last couple of weeks. But overall, you'd have to say that we are in this trade range that's been defined for much of the year, like in this kind of 90, 91 pocket. What do you still think is the next move for the dollar here?
No change really in my view, Patrick. We're consolidating between 89 and 92. And frankly, my feeling is, hey, wake me up when we get a daily close outside of that range. And then I'll try to interpret where this is headed. A confirmed breakdown below 89, that's a pretty key level. So if we got that, it could unleash a tsunami of selling. But as I've said many times before, the clear call here is that fiat currencies are being debased and devalued in terms of their real purchasing power. Remember, the dollar index is relative to other fiat currency. It's much harder to make that relative call than it is to make the absolute call that governments around the world are printing money. Fiat currency is losing value.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because it just doesn't want to quit. It doesn't matter what the inventory numbers are. It just keeps crawling higher. We're now approaching the pre-COVID levels up in the mid-60s as overhead resistance. I have a chart on that for the post-game. But what's your take on all this? How did the inventory numbers come in, and is there more upside on this?
I think there is more upside, but I'll disagree with one part, which is, Patrick, we're already past the pre-COVID levels. Before the COVID crisis began, before COVID really hit the tape, we were in the low 50s. And so we're well above that already. We're not quite back to the January 2020 high yet, which I think is 65, spot 65, or maybe 65, 65 is late 2019. I don't remember. That's the next technical level that I'm watching in any case. And as you said, you know, it's another week and another round of, oh my gosh, what can the market shrug off next when it comes to what should have been bearish news that the market just ignores and powers higher? Last week, it was Saudi Arabia announcing that they were going to reverse their decision on unilateral production cuts. This week, it was inventory, an unexpected build of 1.3 million barrels and an unexpected build of 2.8 million barrels in Cushing, Oklahoma. Now, those are some significant numbers. Any build, frankly, when people were expecting another big drawdown, should have been bearish. Gasoline was pretty much flat at 12,000 barrels a build. The distillate drawdown was significant, though, 5 million barrels. And maybe that's the explanation for why the market didn't even think about going down. It's been straight up. The fact that there was a build on crude oil didn't slow it down. U.S. production collapsed by 1.1 million barrels last week. Wait a minute. Don't get your hopes up that maybe Art Berman is being proven right here. The reason for that collapse of 1.1 million barrels down to 9.7 million barrels reported for U.S. production last week is the Texas freeze-out. I think that's a temporary situation when they get those producing assets back online in Texas after the freeze situation resolves itself. I'm sure that we're going to see a bounce back there. So I don't think that's the big drawdown that Art's been predicting. My next technical target, as I've said, is 65 spot 65 on the April delivery contract for West Texas Intermediate crude. Once you get past that, I'm really starting to feel like, okay, we're in the hard part of this now. It was easy to see that we were going to have a recovery back to these levels. There is a scenario, Patrick, that takes us right back up to all-time highs in the next year, above $147 a barrel, which was the high set in 2008. But that would require a whole bunch of dominoes lining up in a row. You'd have to have a continued recovery in demand. You'd have to see a realization of Art Berman's prediction of a big decline in U.S. production. A whole bunch of things would have to come in line. On the other hand, it could be that we're back up to the resistance level that was containing the market pre-COVID, and maybe that's going to hold at least for a while. We'll see what happens, but I think we're headed to 65 spot 65. I'm going to be watching very closely to see what happens after that. Time spreads, meanwhile, are to the moon. Z1, Z2, my favorite time spread, as everyone knows, touched 4 spot 33 this week, so that's up $7.53, more than $7.50 from where we entered it at minus 3 spot 20 just after the market bottomed. So that's just an epic profit for a one-year time spread. And frankly, I think it's going to $10 before it's done.
All right, Eric, let's move on to gold because the price action remains incredibly weak and almost every rally gets faded and it's distributing down towards six-month lows. We haven't seen a big breakdown move, but certainly it's not being bid. Do you think there's still more downside risk on gold on the short term, and how do you play this out?
Well, I don't think there's any surprise here. And yes, I do think that there's more downside. Exactly as we predicted last week, you know, we've been bouncing back and forth between channel resistance and channel support. That channel is now very well established. As we speak today on Thursday, channel support is at 1746, channel resistance is at 1833. And unless we see an upside breakout with a daily close above 1833, I think we continue to trade downwards in this channel. And that's absolutely to be expected because we've got yields backing up so much. And so far, the inflation that I think really and truly is there isn't being recorded. And therefore, the reported real rates, the inflation adjusted yield, is going up, not down. And that is always gold's worst enemy. Now, I think if you kind of see the forest beyond the trees, you'll recognize that that inflation is coming. And therefore, I think this is a gift. I've been buying mining shares hand over fist this week. That's not because I think the bottom is in. I think we still have lower to go. But I think we're already into the buying zone. I think that this is where you want to be buying gold and gold miners. I've been a little bit overweight bullion and underweight mining shares, so I'm picking up the mining shares here. And I think that we probably have lower prices still to come before this is over. It really depends on when we get a turnaround in real interest rates. And I don't expect that to happen until the inflation, which I believe is already happening, is recognized by the authorities and reported in the official data.
All right, Eric, let's wrap up by touching on the 10-year Treasury yield. I actually have some interest rate charts I want to talk about in the post game, but boy, did interest rates really start to move here in the last few weeks. I mean, we were just at 1% a month ago. We cleared 1.50 here throughout the day, and so like interest rates are just ripping higher. What do you make of all of this?
Well, Patrick, the clear question is how far can it go? And frankly, I think our audience has already heard my answer, which is I'm not really sure, but it really depends, I think, on the question of how far does the Fed feel like they want to let it go? Because they do have the tools. You know, they've got yield control capacity if they want to impose it. So the question is how far are they going to let this go? And how far does the Fed think that they have the latitude to allow it to go? Patrick, I think what I can contribute here is to start asking all of our expert feature interview guests that question, because I think that's the key question of early 2021. And so we'll start with Lynn Alden in today's feature interview. I'll certainly be asking her that question along with quite a few others.
All right. Well, this week's feature interview guest is Lynn Alden. Now, Eric, why did we invite Lynn back on the show this week?
Well, counter to what most people seem to have assumed when we had Mike Green on, we really did intend to get a Bitcoin bear and a Bitcoin bull on the program. We booked Mike and Lynn Alden at the same time because I know that Lynn has an intelligent and well-thought-out view on Bitcoin. She's an analyst I respect, and she's very much a Bitcoin bull. So I wanted to include that and also just get an update because I don't remember how long it's been, Patrick, but you know, she's a very smart woman. We haven't had her on the program in, I think, at least 6 months. So it was time to get her back.
Well, Eric's interview with Lynn Alden is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abex Technologies, which also sponsors my new Smarter Markets podcast, which airs every Saturday morning and explores how the markets themselves could be re-engineered to better serve market participants and society as a whole. My interview with outspoken green energy proponent Tom Raftery is available now at smartermarketspod.com. My guest on Smarter Markets this coming Saturday morning will be John Goldstein, who heads up the sustainable investments practice for Goldman Sachs. We'll talk about all things ESG and how Goldman approaches them. But you won't get Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to separately subscribe to Smarter Markets in your podcast app to receive this free new podcast.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Lynn Alden, founder of Lynn Alden Investment Strategy. And the title of Lynn's slide deck, which I strongly encourage you to download, is Fiscal Dominance. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not registered yet at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button just above Lynn's picture, which says looking for the downloads. Lynn, before we get into the slide deck, I want to start with the big picture. We've been looking for a deflationist. I got a feeling that's not you because you've been on the inflation theme for quite a while. But I'm curious, I know you listen to the show, what do you make of all the prominent deflationists flipping to inflation? Seems to me like this is kind of a sign here. What do you make of this?
Well, I think there's a couple factors. And, you know, first of all, thanks for having me. So the two main things I think are, one is there's no doubt that we're clearly in a cyclical upswing in inflation. And so I think one of the deflationist counterpoints would say, okay, we're of course in a cyclical reflationary bounce. But then the bigger question is this going to turn into something longer term and more structural? Or is it just this kind of bounce we're having because we're having, you know, we're coming out of a pretty deep issue. And so that's kind of the first point. And I think the second point is that we actually have had some really big changes compared to how previous recessions were handled. And we have to pretty much go back to, you know, as far back as the 40s to kind of find similar fiscal and monetary situations as we're seeing now. And so I think that's led a number of people to see that the inflation theme is pretty real, subject to certain things going forward. And so, you know, one way I would describe it is that, you know, I think inflationists, deflationists agree on a lot of the same facts, which is that we do have very large deflationary forces in the economy. And so that's very high debt levels, that's growing technology, and that's the trend of offshoring. It's also demographics and a top-heavy, you know, slowing population, aging population situation in most of the developed world. And so we have these deflationary forces. And then the big question is, you know, will the governments come in with large fiscal spending, QE for the people that you've been talking about for a while, things like that, and if they will override those forces or not. And I think that's kind of the big thing that kind of differentiates deflationists from inflationists. And I think some of the people that switched are showing that, you know, this time the fiscal authorities are pretty serious about kind of, you know, trying to override those deflationary forces.
Lynn, let's move on to your slide deck. Slide number 2 is titled Fiscal Spending, Not Just QE. Tell us more.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things we've noticed over the past cycle was a lot of people thought that QE would be hyperinflationary and that, you know, expanding the amount of base money in the system would basically result in too much money chasing too much goods and therefore you'd have inflation. But the, you know, the shortcoming with that analysis was that there was no way to get that money out into the broad economy. It just stayed in bank reserves and it didn't really, you know, the average Joe or Jane on the street didn't get more money in any of their bank accounts. And that's because, you know, when you increase the base money, there's only two main reasons or two main ways that it can get into the broad money supply. One is that banks can lend it, which they haven't been doing very much. And, you know, partially because there's not a ton of demand or the demand is kind of spread out, or the government can run very large fiscal deficits and basically go around the banking system and inject that capital into the broad money supply. And so back in the 2008, 2009, 2010 period, we didn't really see that happen. And so this chart shows this is the year-over-year change in dollar terms of the broad money supply of the Federal Reserve balance sheet and government transfer payments. And so what we saw was that, you know, during those periods of QE from the past decade, they weren't combined with, you know, fiscal spending to any significant degree. And so that QE just stayed in bank reserves and just, you know, increased base money without really having much of an effect on broad money. And then what we saw, however, this time was that when you combine that QE with very, very large fiscal injections, that puts all that money right into the broad money supply as well. And so we've seen, you know, in the United States, we've seen more than a 25% year-over-year increase in the broad money supply, which is a rate that we haven't seen since the 1940s. And that's because, you know, when you have that combination of fiscal spending and the Federal Reserve buying a lot of the bonds associated with that fiscal spending with brand new base money, that does, you know, that does put it into the broad money supply that we haven't seen in several cycles.
Let's talk about how far this can go and where it's headed, because there have been times in the past where there just wasn't political will to do a whole lot more, you know, government deficit spending because there were enough people voting against it and so forth. It seems like the tide has changed. The political will is there for as much government spending and stimulus spending as anybody wants to contemplate. And the usual arguments for what can go wrong if you use too much deficit spending are it can lead to runaway inflation and it can lead to potentially a crisis in bond markets if you get to an over-indebted situation where markets think it's impossible for that money ever to be repaid, which I would argue we're already there. It seems to me, though, the other side of this is the MMT argument that says, hey, as long as you can print money and borrow in your own currency, you're not going to have a problem repaying the loans because you can repay them with printed money, and therefore you're never going to have that bond market crisis. I don't think it's truly never. I think it's you can stave off the bond market crisis for quite a bit longer than a country that's unable to borrow in its own currency. How do you see this, Lynn? How far could we go? How many years of excessive deficit spending, massive fiscal injection that you're talking about here can be sustained before something breaks?
So that'll partially depend on some of the other inflationary and deflationary forces. And so, for example, if you combine this massive fiscal spending with a shift in globalization, so we've had this multi-year, multi-decade period of globalization, which has been largely deflationary for the developed world. If you start to reverse that, if you start to say for national security purposes or for kind of a change in what we're optimizing for, if we're trying to create more domestic manufacturing jobs, for example, and you start to reshore supply chains, that's an inflationary force. In addition, you have to look at the commodity cycle. I think a lot of inflationists and deflationists, because they focus heavily on the economy part of it, they don't really look at the commodity CapEx cycle. And so obviously, when there's a period of commodity oversupply, you can get away with you basically have that extra capacity to print more without having as tangible consequences. But if you run into periods where there hasn't been a lot of commodity spending in a while, and you're actually pretty tight with your supply-demand characteristic, if you start to run hot, that'll show up in commodities a lot quicker. And so those are some of the forces, I think, that overall determine it. But really what it comes down to is that the argument about monetary sovereign is correct in a sense. And so basically, unlike a country that's not monetary sovereign, like, for example, emerging market that borrowed in dollars, or the countries in the Eurozone, they actually, those types of countries have a risk of an actual nominal default on their sovereign debt. Whereas countries that are monetary sovereign, they have the option to transform that into currency weakness. And so that's kind of the big choice they have, is that, instead of nominal defaulting, they can just default in real terms, which is, kind of a politer way of defaulting. And so if you look at slide 3, for example, the United States has gone through this before when we've had extremely high sovereign debt as a percentage of GDP. And of course, that was back in the 1940s. And it's interesting because when we have these long-term debt cycles play out, they've followed this general pattern where first you have a private debt bubble. That's the more deflationary one because you have a destruction and you have a deleveraging that happens in the economy. And you kind of push a lot of that debt up to the sovereign level. And so that's kind of that long period, and there's usually a stagnation associated with that. Both in the 1930s, we had obviously a very slow economy, and in the 2010s, by most ways of measuring it, were in some ways a mild depression. You had basically a very, very slow growing economy by most metrics, and you had it was particularly in the industrial sector. And whereas the 1940s kind of came around, and the external catalyst of the war forced the government to basically ramp up massive deficit spending, and that was of course on domestic manufacturing and training and all sorts of industrialization. But that, of course, caused a lot of inflation because you ran into commodity scarcity. You basically, used every bit of capacity that you had, and you increased the broad money supply a ton because the Federal Reserve was buying a lot of those bonds. And so what they had to do was institute yield curve control, which is basically that they kept yields below the inflation rate for roughly a decade. And I know you talked to Kevin the other week about it as well. I thought that was a great discussion because there's actually a couple ways to do it. You can just peg the short end of the curve, and then the government kind of refinances its debt to lower duration, or they can cap the whole end of the curve. But the ultimate, kind of the end game there is that bonds spend a long period of time failing to keep up with inflation. And so even though they're all paid back in nominal terms, they lose a lot of purchasing power in real terms. And I think one of the concerns is that we're probably heading to one of those environments where sovereign debt levels are high enough, and that the Federal Reserve has shown a willingness to hold rates at zero and let inflation run hot. And so that's not generally an environment you want to be holding a lot of paper assets in.
Moving on to slide 4, you're distinguishing fiscal from monetary dominance. Explain what that means.
People often point out that if you don't have bank lending, you can't get a growth in the money supply. And that's not quite true because, ironically, the biggest year-over-year increases in the broad money supply are periods where banks aren't lending, such as the 1940s and 2020. And that's because, as I previously mentioned, the fiscal authority can go around the banking channel by basically sending out checks or directly spending on projects and having a lot of those bonds financed on the secondary market by the Federal Reserve with new base money creation. And so these two charts, one shows on the left there, that shows short-term interest rates in the orange line, and it shows the monetary base as a percentage of GDP. And it shows that once you hit the zero bound, the Federal Reserve gets starts to get more limited in their options, and you can do things like reduce the the dollar relative to gold, or you can do things like QE to increase the monetary base as a percentage of GDP. And of course, that's what we saw there. But even then, that starts to run into issues because it's not really circulating the money around. You start to get a collapse in money velocity, and you're not really increasing the money supply, the broad money supply enough. And that's where eventually, you know, the situation gets painful enough that more and more people demand larger fiscal spending, or there's some sort of external catalyst, whether it's a pandemic or a war or something like that. And we kind of shift over to fiscal dominance, which is basically whether or not inflation comes largely depends on if they're going to devalue their currency and essentially print. And so the second chart there shows, it's a similar chart. It shows the monetary base and the deficits, but it shows the money multiplier, you know, M2 compared to the monetary base. And it shows, you know, a lot of people like to show the chart that we've had over the past 40 years of collapsing money multiplier. But we've actually been in a similar situation before if you look back to the 30s and 40s. And we're kind of seeing a similar deficit response there. That basically, again, that goes to the point where when banks aren't lending, you know, the indirect way they can lend is that they buy a lot of treasuries and, you know, the treasury spends. And that's kind of what we're seeing.
Lynn, let's talk about how long this can last and what the big picture consequences are. Because if I understand you correctly, and by the way, we're very much in agreement on this, it seems like there could be a period of many years of lots and lots of fiscal stimulus, lots of deficit spending that is going to have the effect through financial repression of essentially inflating away the real purchasing value of the national debt. And the consequence of that, as you said, is it's kind of the more polite way of defaulting. You're defaulting in real terms, but not in nominal terms. So the bonds all get paid back, but the fiat currency that they're being paid back with has less purchasing power than the fiat currency that was borrowed when those bonds were created. If that's the long-term outlook, and I agree with you, I think that it is, what does that mean in this devaluing of fiat currency? I think happens across the board. It's not just the U.S. dollar. It's all fiat currency. Most people would say, okay, real assets is the place to be, things like real estate and precious metals and so forth. Is that the right way of thinking about this, or how should we as investors think about what this whole inflation and financial repression, this whole big picture that you've laid out here of fiscal dominance and the shift that you see coming, what does it mean in terms of big picture macro asset allocation strategy?
Yeah, so historically, if you look at the 1940s and the 1970s, which were the two inflationary decades over the past century, you know, both instances, of course, commodities did very well. That's almost a requisite for having inflation is high commodity prices. And so that's kind of one of the key places to be. Real estate with fixed rate debt is also generally does pretty well. Value stocks can do pretty well. The big trouble areas you run into are with long duration bonds and with growth stocks. And that's because, you know, if you look in these two periods, even though, of course, again, bonds all got paid back in nominal terms, in terms of, you know, their devaluation compared to official CPI was 30 to 40% in both of those decades, depending on, you know, exactly what time period you start from and what portion of the curve you're looking at. And so those are kind of the trouble areas to be, whereas being in value stocks, being in commodities, those generally hold up better. And I think, you know, going forward, multiple fiat currencies are going to devalue, but not necessarily all at the same rate. And so, you know, we have kind of different countries around the world that have, you know, some of their indexes have more value exposure. Some of them, I think, have a slightly better currency fundamentals than others. And so there's kind of ways to, you know, kind of pick your equities in such a way that you have a little bit less inflation risk compared to some of the names that might be more impacted. And for example, on chart five here, one of the risks we're facing now, and I've been writing about this in an article or a newsletter recently, and this week in particular, we're kind of getting a lot of more narratives about it, is that higher yields are putting pressure on growth stocks in particular. And so we've had this, you know, multi-year period where tech stocks and growth stocks have largely outpaced other types of investments, but that's in big part because of valuation. And so it's not as though their earnings grew, and we've had this kind of doubling in you know, growth stocks over the past, you know, 2-3 years because of their earnings. That's obviously been a part of it, but a lot of it was just due to valuation expansion. And so the chart I have here is Apple as an example, which is that, you know, their earnings have done fine, you know, large part because of buybacks, but also just because their business was fundamentally strong against the pandemic. But you see that their valuation just absolutely skyrocketed over the past couple of years. And so their earnings growth hasn't really, you know, the overall earnings trajectory hasn't really changed that much, but the market has been much more willing to pay a high multiple. And so you see the black line skyrocket, that's the stock price. And then you see, you know, what the stock price would be at historically normal valuation multiples in blue and orange there. And that just shows that we've had a big decoupling in investor expectations from what earnings have been and what analysts expect those earnings to continue to be. And that's been largely predicated on super low interest rates. And so if you start to get an uptick on the long end of the curve, which we've been seeing recently, that can put a lot of headwinds on growth stocks. And we saw that back in the 1970s as well, where, you know, you had those nifty 50 stocks that came into the decade with very high valuations. And they were companies we know today, like Coca-Cola and Disney and Xerox and things like that. And even though they all went on to do very well fundamentally over the next several decades, they ran into significant headwinds over the next, you know, 10 to 15 years from those high valuation points, because they were up against much more inflationary pressures, and their very high valuations came into issue because, you know, when you run the discounted cash flow analysis, companies with more of their earnings deep in the future, more growth-oriented companies, they're the ones that are more interest rate sensitive. And so that's why we're seeing more and more pressure on, you know, some of these growth stocks in particular. And Apple, of course, is not even the most extreme example. The most extreme example would be unprofitable growth companies that are even more highly valued, and they're the ones that are getting hit even harder.
Let's talk a little bit more about that uptick in long-term yields. There's a narrative in the marketplace that kind of makes sense, but boy, if it was wrong, it leaves a lot of room for a lot of people to be very sorely disappointed. And the narrative goes, look, those long-term yields can't move much farther than they have already, because there's just too much to lose for the U.S. government if they go too far, and the Fed has the tools to contain them. So they're going to do yield control. We don't have to worry about long-term yields backing up too far. Is that sound logic? And if not, why not?
So I have somewhat of a flowchart that I put in my last newsletter, which is, I think in some way they're going to keep a large portion of the yield curve below the inflation rate, but there's no guarantee they're going to keep the long end of the curve below the inflation rate. And I think you had a great discussion with Kevin on it, you know, about that before, which is that, you know, one of the options for keeping government financing costs low, even if, you know, the long end of the curve increases, is that the Treasury can decrease the average duration of their treasuries, and therefore they can get the benefits of having basically the pin near zero yields, even if the long end goes up to 2%, 3%, 4% or more. Now, I think the big question is, what will that start breaking in the market? And so, you know, historically, the Fed's not a particularly proactive organization. They kind of respond in the sense of putting out fires. And so, for example, if you look at Q4 2018, there was a famous Powell pivot. You know, they were talking about, you know, letting the balance sheet run off on autopilot. They were hiking rates. And then eventually that caused, you know, we saw that big growth stock sell off in Q4 2018. But I think more importantly, under the surface, is that there were no junk bonds issued in like a 6-week period there. We pretty much had a freezing in some of the risk section of the credit markets. And so Powell had to come out and say, oh, we're just kidding, we're data dependent. You know, of course, we're going to adjust as needed. And so the market cooled off. And then later that you know, year in 2019, the Fed started cutting rates. And we saw a similar situation again in late 2019, where once the repo rate spike happened, that forced the Fed to begin expanding their balance sheet again to quell that fire. And so I think, you know, my base case is that, you know, the Fed's not going to intervene overhandedly more than they're already doing. I mean, they're already holding rates at zero. They're already buying at an $80 billion monthly rate for treasuries. And so I think, you know, their plan is to pretty much let long-end yields kind of continue to go up until it breaks something. And if it starts to break something, they might have to step in and do something. But I wouldn't expect them to necessarily kind of rush in and put out a fire proactively.
Lynn, we got some interesting feedback from that conversation that you mentioned with Kevin last week, where a couple of listeners wrote us and said, look, the point that you're missing is the reason the Fed can't let the long end of the curve move much higher is if they did that, it would just clobber residential real estate, which depends on those 30-year bonds to price 30-year mortgages. And that's the reason they can't do it. And I had to think about that. I thought, wait a minute. If the Fed were really into prudence and responsibility and supporting the American public with providing the right backdrop for responsibility, that might be true. But what's to stop them, as you say, from letting the long end of the curve go to the point where people are priced out of doing what you said just a few minutes ago was the smart thing to do in this economic environment, which is to look at real estate with fixed interest rates? What if fixed interest rates, 30-year mortgages, are basically priced out of reach to most people and they have to look at short-term variable adjustable interest rate loans because that's the only way to get an affordable payment to buy real estate? And of course, that's a setup for when rates ultimately do change, that it creates a crisis. Is that something we should be concerned about? How do you think about that argument that real estate would be the reason that the Fed can't afford to let the long end of the curve go too far?
Well, I think that's an overall good argument. It kind of touches on what I pointed out, that you know they basically would wait for something to break most likely, and that could be the real estate market. That could also be credit market, especially some of the companies that are on the riskier side of the spectrum. And I think from a free market standpoint, we'd want to see that. We want to see kind of rates go up and kind of businesses that can't handle that probably shouldn't be in business anyway, or they should be restructured and that's on them. We should see kind of a rational pricing in equity markets and real estate markets. And so, a lot of us would hope for that. But I think from, a macroeconomic standpoint, when you start to have too many things like that start to break and that kind of threatens the growth narrative, that's when I think there's a higher probability of the Fed stepping in and potentially, putting downward pressure on the long end of the curve. And they might or might not do, hard cap the yield curve, but for example, they might increase purchases on the long end, or they might, use various ways. I know Russell Napier's gone into a couple of things that they can do to increase buying on the long end through financial repression. And so, there are, I think, both sides of the argument, I think, have a point, which is that, we don't exactly know where the pain points are. And I think that the Fed's going to kind of fish for those and see, where the pain points are hit. And, it's at that point where they might step in and do something a little bit more heavy handed. And that, it's not just for federal financing. It's also to your point about real estate markets and credit.
Moving on to page 6 in your slide deck, I'm fascinated here to see that since 2000, U.S. dollar broad money supply has more than quadrupled in a period when Japanese yen money supply has less than doubled. It's not exactly like the Bank of Japan has a reputation for being stingy about expanding its money supply. What's going on here, Lynn?
Yeah, so one of the reasons I'm showing this chart is because there's always kind of the question that pops up is, well, what about Japan? I mean, they printed a ton of money and they had no inflation for decades. And so can't we print a ton of money and turn out like Japan? And there's a couple key differences. So one is they run a current account surplus, a pretty structural one. And so that kind of gives them somewhat of a natural floor to their currency. But another point is that they actually have had very slow broad money supply growth. And so all of the printing fest we've seen going on in Japan has been in their base money rather than their broad money. And that goes back to the point of, just because you increase base money doesn't necessarily put that into broad money unless either banks are lending or the government's running very large fiscal deficits. And in Japan's case, it's kind of a moderate sense because, the government has run pretty significant fiscal deficits. They are the highest debt to GDP country in the world, but it's not quite the same as people would expect. And so the average Japanese budget deficit during this 20-year period was something around 5% of GDP, which is significant. It's, that's a pretty sizable average deficit, but that's nothing like the 15 to 20% deficits that we're seeing now that are kind of outright, money printing. And that was also offset by a very significant structural corporate deleveraging that happened in Japan that they've been going through for decades now, ever since they had that massive bubble in the late 80s and kind of letting out of that bubble throughout the 90s. And we've seen this kind of massive ongoing structural deleveraging. And so you had about 2% of GDP per year reduction in corporate debt during this time. And so overall, that really kind of offset some of the government money printing. You basically transferred debt from the private sector more to the public sector. And so overall, we've actually had pretty slow broad money supply growth in Japan. And it averaged something like 2.9% per capita. And so even when you adjust this for the fact that, the United States had higher population growth than Japan, even when you account for that difference, you know, you've had a much smaller broad money supply growth, both in absolute basis and per capita basis in Japan. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why Japan is not a very accurate comparison for what the United States is going through now, because again, they're a structural current account surplus nation, and also they were actually growing money supply, you know, broad money supply very slowly.
Lynn, let's move on to page 7. What's going on here? It says Japan's quiet bull market.
So this focuses on, you know, some of the previous things we talked about, which was their explosion in base money. And so, you know, a lot of people point out that Japan's been in a 30-year bear market, which is totally true, but it's not been a totally linear process. And so there's been a couple of different phases that they've gone through. And you know, another way to describe it really is that their bear market pretty much went from 1990 through about 2012. And that was where, you know, their stock market indices, they kept hitting lower lows, lower highs. And it was just a very terrible time to be in Japanese equities. But ever since late 2012, you've actually had one of the strongest bull market in equities, both in their local currency and in dollar terms, you know, around the world. And so, you know, they've pretty much been second to the United States in terms of how strong their market's been over the past, you know, 8 or 9 years. It's funny because that correlates heavily with when their central bank balance sheet started going vertical. And so prior to that, they were, you know, expanding their balance sheet, but it was really in Q4 2012 where they really started ramping up their balance sheet. And of course, they're famous among central banks for buying some of their own domestic equities. And so of course, that had upward moves on price as well. But the interesting thing is that if you look at most valuation metrics, even after this pretty strong run that Japanese equities have had, they're not really expensive by most metrics. If you look at price to earnings, price to book, price to free cash flow, things like that, they're actually, you know, reasonably valued compared to some other markets. And so it's not as though they've caused another bubble, at least not in kind of Japanese you know, equity valuation terms. They might have caused a currency bubble, they might have caused other issues. So it's just kind of an interesting thing to watch is that we've actually, you know, no one's really talking about the bull market in Japan, but we've actually been in a pretty strong one ever since late 2012. And we've also seen a period of basically improving corporate governance. And so if you look at slide 8, for example, these are the Japanese trading companies. And they made headlines last year because Warren Buffett of Berkshire announced that Berkshire accumulated like a $6 billion position in these companies. They actually bought 5% of each of the top 5 companies. And so that was an interesting choice because, you know, in many ways, they're classic Buffett stocks. They're low price book, low price earnings. They pay dividends. You know, they're kind of out of favor at the current time. But if you look deeper into it, there's actually, I think, more going on there. And so, you know, these were kind of part of the classic bubble over the past several decades in Japan. Their overall debt levels were extremely high. But over this past several decades, they've been part of this corporate deleveraging process in Japan, where they have massively improved their balance sheet and reduced their debt loads. And it's something we've seen in other companies as well. We've also seen, you know, kind of more qualitative shifts. And so you've seen the way that they handle their board of directors over time has shifted. They have more outside directors, including non-Japanese directors, because many of these companies operate globally. And you see kind of more of a shift towards, you know, kind of high returns on capital, improved shareholder returns, rather than emphasis on growth or, you know, just kind of this passive investment strategy. And so overall, it's just kind of an interesting thing to watch because, you know, a lot of people think that Japan's been rather kind of stagnant for the past 30 years. But again, and really in the past decade or so, there's actually been a lot changing under the surface. In addition, some of these companies, you know, Japan's kind of famous for their conglomerates, and that's what these Japanese trading companies are. But they've actually, you know, they started to make a lot of changes in recent years to kind of shift and be more proactive with their portfolio. And so, you know, one of the examples I've used is Hitachi. You know, they're kind of the GE of Japan, you could say. And they've been divesting a lot of their non-core areas of business, their lower margin businesses, and kind of, you know, streamlining their company to kind of focus on their core competence. And a similar thing here with the trading companies, they've really kind of shifted around their assets a little bit and started focusing more on dividend growth, more on improving their returns on equity, and really about having a more reasonable balance sheet. And so if you look on slide 9, for example, I highlighted one of those trading companies. This is Mitsui. And so, you know, this one's not particularly special among them. It's kind of like the medium-sized one. But I just wanted to show that, you know, because they're, you know, if you look at what these Japanese trading companies do, they're heavily into commodities. And so they do commodity, you know, they finance commodity exploration around the world. They have, you know, many of them have energy exposure. They have copper exposure. Some of them have uranium exposure, all sorts of different metals and energy. But then they also do industrial. So they, you know, many of them are involved with plant construction around the world, kind of infrastructure projects, supply chains, manufacturing, things like that. And so, you know, they've actually done quite well considering that, you know, they've been in an environment that was not very favorable to them. And so if you look at Mitsui here, for example, I have the earnings per share and the dividends in yen. And, you know, they had a really big run up in the 2000s because that's, of course, when we had a very strong commodity market. So that was a great environment to be a commodity and industrial company. You had the growth in emerging markets. But then, of course, we had that big shift. We had the global financial crisis. And we've been in like this 12-year commodity bear market. And it's been really rough for the companies. But at the same time, because they've had such a strong improvement in their corporate governance and the way they handle their business, they've actually been able to continue growing dividends. And they've been able to hold their earnings pretty much in a sideways trend, despite the, you know, the kind of the pain points we've had in commodities. And so I think that a lot of these companies actually have a really good base to build from, you know, where they've had kind of a rough decade, but under the surface, they've improved a lot.
Lynn, let's move on to gold, a subject that is near and dear to many of our listeners' hearts. I see you have a couple of charts here on page 10. You know, I find it fascinating. Intuitively, it would seem as if reflation ought to be good for gold. But actually, if you look at history, reflation is awfully bad for gold, particularly for gold mining shares. Is that because you tend to have during reflation a picking up of the back end of the yield curve, and the result of that is higher real interest rates, which are an enemy to gold? Or why is it that we're not seeing strength that intuitively associated with inflation of any kind you might expect in gold?
So that's the strongest correlation that gold's had over the past 50 years is real rates. And so people often look to the dollar or other factors, and those all influence some of the moves that gold can make. But really the strongest one over the past 50 years has been real rates. And specifically the 10-year has been kind of the key one to watch. And so what we saw from late 2018 to mid-2020 is we saw a really significant reduction in real rates from positive 1% to negative 1% for the 10-year treasury. So that, of course, has been a rocket fuel for gold. We've had a massive bull run from, you know, about 1,200 to over 2,000 briefly in gold, and it's been a very good environment for it. But ever since August 2020, we've actually been in this kind of choppy sideways pattern for real rates, because even though inflation expectations are rising, we're also, of course, getting a sharp uptick in 10-year and longer duration yields. And that's kept up with inflation. And in recent weeks, it's outpaced inflation. And so we've actually had, you know, we've come off the lows in terms of real rates. And so this is not super uncommon when you look at reflation scenarios, which is that gold, you know, tends to do very well in a disinflationary environment, ironically, when you have nominal yields falling faster than inflation expectations, because that's another way to get lower real yields. Whereas when we come out of that, that's when you see things like silver and copper and energy do well. And so if you look at things like the gold to silver ratio or the gold to copper ratio, you know, they really bottomed or topped, I should say, in early 2020. And since then, we've really had some of these other more reflationary commodities take over from gold in terms of kind of carrying the torch forward in terms of returns. However, of course, the major variable to watch, I think, if you were to get some sort of yield curve control or some sort of inflation spike that kind of drives real yields lower again, that's when gold would do very well. And so even if you look back, for example, the 1970s, which we think of as, you know, the amazing bull market for gold, that really kind of came in two big spikes. There's one in the mid-70s, and then, of course, the final one at the end of the 70s. And those two periods had negative 4% real yields. And so even within a structural bull market, gold's movements are largely dependent on what's happening with real yields. And so we've had this period where we got a little bit overbought this summer. And since then, it's because we've had real yields stabilize and even back off from their lows, gold's been under some pressure. But I would still arguably say that it's pretty much done its job, because it has increased over the past couple of years about as fast as broad money supply. And so basically, according to the models that I follow, I classify gold as roughly fairly valued at the current time. And so it's neither really underperforming expectations or outperforming expectations. And I think the key thing to watch going forward is that if we're still expecting pretty significant broad money supply growth, which if some of these stimulus packages continue to materialize is likely, then gold should eventually catch a bid, but it will largely depend on what happens with the long end of the rate curve.
Let's talk a little bit more about that and what could happen with the long end of the rate curve, because it seems to me that if you think the reasons that the back end of the yield curve is already turning up have to do with reflation and that it's likely that inflation measures are soon going to catch up with that, well, then this is a gift. It's time to buy gold hand over fist on its weakness, expecting inflation to overtake the increase in long-dated treasury yields. Of course, the way you could blow up on that trade is if it turns out the inflation doesn't really get registered, at least in terms of the measures that people use, but the back end of the curve continues to increase anyway. What are the scenarios that could cause the long-dated treasury yields to continue to back up and move higher without any inflation coming into the system? I don't really see any. Am I missing something?
Well, I think the main one is that if you look at the 10-year rate, it's, you know, even after the nice run-up it's had, it's still below 10-year break-evens. And so that's, you know, pretty unusual over the past 15 years or so. And so, you know, based on just pure logic, you'd expect that even if inflation were to stay relatively flat, the nominal yield should increase a little bit just to, you know, basically stop having negative real yields. And so I think that that's one of the scenarios to watch out for is that, you know, even if you get kind of this flat inflation environment, if the market just stops expecting more and more disinflation and starts saying, okay, we might get inflation in the future, or we want to make sure that we're, you know, earning a yield that's higher than inflation, you basically could have, you know, demand weakness until yields get high enough to warrant people to come back into the market. And so I think that's one of the biggest concerns to watch out for. And in many ways, gold's been kind of tracking along with growth stocks, ironically, because they're, you know, those are kind of the duration trades. Like we've seen kind of a growth to value rotation around the same time as gold started underperforming. And that's, you know, gold's largely been in this defensive bucket along with, you know, kind of tech and growth stocks and things like that. And it's been, you know, kind of weak compared to some of the other things like copper and silver and, you know, platinum's even taken off lately. And so I generally find that one of the best ways to play this is have somewhat of a mix. And so I've liked gold, I've liked silver, I've liked copper and energy and Bitcoin and basically, you know, uranium, kind of a spectrum of different sort of commodities so that weakness in one or two of them doesn't really throw off the portfolio.
Let's drill down on Bitcoin, because when I had Mike Green on the program a few weeks ago, there was an outcry from listeners saying, you got to have somebody who likes Bitcoin on the program. Actually, we scheduled Mike and you at the same time, knowing that we would get both sides of the argument. Tell us the other side of the argument. Feel free to criticize Mike's arguments. I know he won't mind if you do that. What did Mike and I get wrong in our discussion of Bitcoin, and where do you think it's headed?
Well, I don't want to really not necessarily want to touch on Mike's arguments in particular, but overall, I think, you know, if we look at the long-term history of what Bitcoin's doing, it's still largely on track to what it's done in every cycle. And so, you know, people often try to find what exactly Bitcoin is correlated to, and in some ways, it changes over time. I mean, sometimes it's correlated to the dollar, sometimes it's correlated to the S&P 500, sometimes it's not. And, you know, the biggest correlation, kind of like any growth stock, is that it's correlated to its own kind of adoption profile, like how much that kind of particular thing is taking off. And so, you know, as Bitcoin's been used more and more, it's gone up in price, obviously. But the key thing to follow historically has been its supply halving cycle. And so, you know, everybody knows about Bitcoin's 21 million hard cap. But if you look at how we reach that hard cap, it's not in a linear line. And so in the beginning, when Bitcoin was created, 50 new Bitcoins were generated every 10 minutes on the blockchain, you know, as a gift to miners for verifying the blockchain. And, you know, that you know, keeps going algorithmically every 10 minutes. But once you get to about 4 years, which is block 210,000, you have a pre-programmed supply flow halving, which is that the number of Bitcoins generated every 10 minutes drops to 25. And then 4 years later, it drops at 12.5. And generally what we see during these supply halvings is it causes kind of a classic supply shock, you know, kind of similar to what you see in any commodity, which is that if demand remains relatively persistent, but if the new supply gets reduced for one reason or another, in this case, because it's pre-programmed, then you generally start to see upward pressure on the price. And then when you have that upward pressure on the price, you have momentum traders come on board, it reaches more people, you kind of have more awareness of it, and you have that, eventually you have a blow off top, and then you have a crash and a consolidation, and then 4 years later, the same thing happens again and creates like another kind of adoption period. And so far, Bitcoin's, you know, kind of behaved in this oddly algorithmic way, which is that its bull markets and bear markets have been largely predictable, you know, around its supply halving cycle. And there, you know, there are a variety of kind of on-chain indicators to look at. And so a lot of people just look at the price, but you can dive into the protocol. And I included one slide here, but you know, any analyst that kind of covers this is looking at dozens of these. And so this chart, for example, shows the HODL wave, which is it's analyzing the behavior of long-term Bitcoin holders. And so, you know, there's a lot of trading activity on exchanges, but one of the big questions is, you know, the long-term whales or the long-term holders, what are they doing with their coins? Because that can sometimes give us a signal for what's happening in these bull or bear runs that we're having. And so if you look at this cycle, when we have these really big bull runs in Bitcoin, you start to get a gradual sell-off among long-term holders, which is the yellow line. Basically, that the percentage of Bitcoin that are held for more than 1 year starts to decrease, because when people have life-changing money from 5x or 10x gains, they start to sell into that, and you start to get that, you know, kind of shift onto newer buyers. And we've seen this in every bull market cycle so far. And basically, you know, the summary here is that most indicators suggest that Bitcoin is probably still within its bull run. We've had a couple corrections, which are normal within these cycles. And of course, there's no guarantee going forward. But if you look at, you know, what's happening with Bitcoin's leaving exchanges, if you look at the behavior of long-term holders, if you look at kind of the supply-demand characteristics, if you look at how many Bitcoins were mined this year compared to, you know, how many grayscales and MicroStrategies and NYDIGs and things like that kind of soaked up coins and put them into cold storage. Overall, it's still pretty bullish for the protocol, probably extending, you know, maybe out to the second half of 2021. And if true, that could also continue to put pressure on gold, at least in this particular year.
I'm fascinated by the left-hand chart, the market price chart on slide 11. It seems to me that where you're showing this correlation to the pre-programmed supply flow halvings here, you could apply, it's not quite a measured move technique in technical analysis. It's more like a logarithmic measured move. But it seems to me you ought to be able to at least project where that next blow-off top peak approximately happens just by using the last few cycles on the log scale in order to do something like a measured move. Is there such a number? Is there a number in your mind for where the next blow-off top happens?
So this is something I've thought about, and I try not to give specific price projections, especially because some of those spikes can be kind of illiquid, and so that can really depend on what's happening with a pretty small number of traders in kind of that euphoric blow-off top phase. But overall, there are some models that show this. And so, you know, if you look at that first peak there, you know, that was, you know, a pretty significant run, of course, because you pretty much went up from Bitcoin not being priced at anything to Bitcoin being priced at about 20. And so the next run up reached over 1,000. And so that was about a 50-fold increase from peak to peak. And then the peak that happened in late 2017 was about 20,000. So that was a 20-fold increase over the previous one. And so we've generally seen a pattern where each one of these cycles is explosive, but each one is a smaller percent move than the previous one, which is naturally what you'd expect from a larger, you know, starting point, because, you know, it's the law of large numbers. You can't move a big asset as much as you can a small asset. And so the kind of the big question is, will that pattern continue? So my base case is that this cycle would have smaller percent gains than the previous one, even though it'd still be quite big. And, you know, the kind of the crazy thing with the numbers is that even if you have something that's only 10 times the previous peak, that gets you to a number like 200,000. And so there are basically numbers out there that range from, you know, 120,000 up to 400,000 or more for where this particular blow off top could end. But of course, that'll largely depend on what happens with demand, because supply is known, demand is not. But if it follows anything like the previous time, I don't think a six-figure price, you know, kind of endpoint would be surprising. And so that's kind of how I'm looking at it. And it's funny because it's so far it's outperforming my base case a little bit, because you know, it's, so far it's actually doing better than that 2016-2017 bull run. It's a little bit ahead of where we'd expect it to be at this point in time. Whereas my base case, it was that it would probably lag a little bit. And so, you know, it's possible that I could be proven wrong and that Bitcoin has a stronger run than last time. But overall, my base case would be a big gain, but a smaller percentage gain than last time.
Lynn, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before we let you go, tell our listeners a little bit more about Lynn Alden Investment Strategy, what you do there, and what they can expect to find on your website.
Sure. And again, thanks so much for having me. My website, a lot of it's free material. I publish public articles. I publish a free newsletter every 6 weeks. And then I also have a low-cost paid research service for retail and institutional investors. One of the major goals is to kind of take macro information and kind of distill it into something that is easy to understand. And I also cover individual stocks in that particular service. You know, for example, I went into some of the detail on these Japanese trading companies and things like that. And so overall, my view is kind of an equity-focused macro view.
Well, Lynn, we look forward to getting you back on the show in a few months for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Looking for exposure to rising silver and gold prices? Abra Plata Resource Corporation, ticker ABRA on the TSX Venture Exchange and ABBRF in the United States, is rapidly emerging as one of the premier silver and gold-focused exploration companies. Abra Plata has an advanced stage project with a large resource base of over 140 million ounces on a silver equivalent basis and is focused on unlocking additional high-grade drill results. Abra Plata is very well funded with a strong shareholder base and excellent exploration upside potential. Visit abraplata.com for more information. That's ABRAPLATA.com for more information on this silver and gold exploration stock.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Lynn back on the show. Her data-driven process is just so refreshing, and her rich knowledge of history and the way that the markets have behaved in the past is always a great insight. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, Patrick, Lynn always impresses me. She's a super smart woman. And, you know, I think she's exactly right in the focus of her presentation, which is that we're in a new game now. And that means the rules of the game have changed. We've been used to, for the last several years, knowing that monetary policy is the big driver of markets. And it's, you know, the next FOMC meeting is what you got to watch in order to figure out what's going to happen next. Now it's going to be fiscal spending, which frankly is a little more complicated because, you know, if you thought that the FOMC guys were a bunch of political animals, now it's Congress that's in charge. And so it makes things a little bit more complex and a little more interesting. And I think it means that markets have to get used to essentially a new set of playing rules. In any event, Patrick, let's move on to the post-game chart book, which is titled Markets Buzzing this week. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to macrovoices.com, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads right above Lynn Alden's picture. Patrick, let's dive right in to the S&P on page 2. What's going on here?
Well, it's amazing. Like I only snagged this picture a couple hours ago, and the S&P 500 is 40 points lower than where it's on this image. But what I wanted to just point out on this chart is a technical level of relevance, which is where roughly a 10% market correction would occur to. And what's interesting is that while there's this argument that, you know, there's all this liquidity that could keep driving a bull, the markets often always check their rises. And some mean reverting correction is par for the course, and the 10% correction variety of a drop is usually happens even once or twice a year on a regular basis. And so, with the market having extended as high as it is, we're at a very important moment technically because there's a lot of levels just below this kind of 3,800 level on the S&P that create gamma flips and potential rising volatility will force those vol targeting funds to deleverage and spurs a profit-taking cycle, and particularly since we're seeing many of those FANG stocks under such pressure. And nonetheless, what's interesting is that back in September, October, we saw markets put in their highs more or less around the 3,500 level, and often technically what were previous highs become support. And so it'll be really interesting to see whether the market here triggers a distribution or sell cycle that triggers below 3,800 and creates that little rapid market correction down to the test that level, giving us about that 10% of a correction. And so that's certainly one thing that I'm going to be watching here.
Patrick, in terms of how we might interpret what comes next, a lot of people, and some of them are right and some of them are wrong, but some of them are saying, okay, look at rates backing up. You know, this is going to crash the stock market. Get ready for a new cyclical bear market. What's the level, once we've closed below it, where you really say, okay, look, it's game on for a whole new show here. We're going down, not up. Is it a close below 3,500? What's the signal that tells you the game has changed completely?
Well, that's the whole thing, right? Is that the first kind of 300-400 S&P points down could easily be bought on dip. I mean, like just looking back in September, we had a 300-point drop that took about a month, and it was very easily bought on dip. And so I think the most important thing to do at this moment is to approach it that we're overdue for a market pause and some backfilling to kind of check this rally. But any time a market begins a sell cycle, especially with the amount of emotional froth that has accompanied the markets and the fact that some of the market darlings are selling so hard, it'd be really interesting to see whether or not this could turn into something more of a liquidity event. But I think all of the scary style market drops would be below that 3,500-3,600 level. And I think the most prudent thing is to approach this as first a market correction and then see whether it morphs into something more as it's underway. But Eric, what I wanted to really touch on, let's move on to page 3. And one of the things, even Lynn, when she was on our show many, many months ago, was talking about the equal weight S&P 500 versus the normal market cap weighted. And what's amazing is that the equal weight ETF for the S&P 500 continues to press higher and make higher highs. And it's a real testament to the rotation that's happening. And so the next few charts, I want to talk about this rotation in greater detail. But really what's happening is that in the market cap weighted index, all of those FANG stocks, the Apples and Amazons and Googles and Facebooks of the world and the Teslas are such a huge weighting into the index that now that higher yields are putting pressure on all those stocks, that it's creating a drag, while the things like the financials and cyclicals and the energy stocks and all of these have just been performing extraordinarily well, allowing that someone who positioned themselves in a far more equal weight in the S&P has been outperforming. And that's what that's really showing on page 4 when I'm comparing the SPY ETF versus that equal weight ETF for the S&P 500. I mean, the S&P, since that correction we had in the late third quarter, we really have seen the equal weight index actually outperform the normal S&P 500 by over 10%. And I really think that this storyline continues. And to kind of further support that, if we on page 5, we have that NASDAQ chart. And what's really interesting is obviously NASDAQ is even more overweight, those FANG stocks. And you can really see it starting to crack. I mean, we completely wiped out the February market rally that happened in NASDAQ in one fluid motion. And the relative weakness of the NASDAQ is very evident relative not only to the S&P 500, but also to the small cap index, which is on page 6. You know, small caps continue to hold up not far from their highs. And clearly, this is not where the selling is actually occurring. And so to kind of show that overall pattern on page 7, I have the momentum over value factor. And you can see here, and what it doesn't even show on this chart is for years, we've seen that relative outperformance of momentum over value. And that's been driven by that structurally lower interest rate that was through that deflationary impulse or disinflationary impulse that we've seen up to those lows. And what we've really now seen is now momentum clearly underperforming, and that rotation into value is very evident. And one of the bigger puzzle pieces to watch in the coming for the remainder of the year is this a trend that continues? And it's certainly something that's on my mind.
We've got the VIX on page 8. What's on your mind here?
Well, I thought it was really interesting to observe that the S&P 500, when we had that little correction last month, the VIX spiked all the way up toward 40 in a very rapid fashion. And that actually created this feedback mechanism where the volatility forced deleveraging and actually spurred some of the selling. But what's pretty interesting right now is that the sell-off that we are currently in over the past week has not yet had a response from volatility. Overall, volatility is still somewhat on the lower end of the range, and that volatility premium has not really been coming back yet. And that actually is a red flag to me. I mean, typically traders like to see some sort of a spike in volatility as a signal that that fear has returned, and that panic buying of option hedges forces volatility premiums to spike. And there's simply no sign of it yet. And that kind of makes me ask the question as to whether or not there's still a little bit more selling to come, just because we haven't seen the VIX spike yet. And that's something that I'm watching.
Moving on to page 9, you've got the Euro US dollar cross. Boy, it looks to me like there's maybe an inverse head and shoulders pattern in addition to that trend line break that you see there.
I mean, there certainly is a trend line break and a little bit of a basing formation turning up. And this is the real story. When we always talk about the dollar index, it's trade weighted. Euro is the biggest component. But when you really kind of look at what the pound sterling has been doing, or you look at what the Japanese yen has been doing, they've really been marching to the beat of their own drum. Only really the Canadian dollar and the Aussie dollar have really been getting this tailwind from commodities and continuing to rise. And I think this continues to be one of the most interesting pairs to watch, that Euro-US, because if we legitimately see a breakout here in the Euro, and maybe punching 124, 125 on the upside, that really will solidify that the dollar index still has another leg on the downside to go. And watching whether the breakout that's been happening today on the upside is whether it's a fake out or it's a breakout is definitely, I think, something very important to keep a close eye on here. But Eric, what I wanted to do, though, is move on to page 10, where I have that continuous crude oil futures contract. I obviously cut off the minus 40 print on the bottom just so that the chart isn't so zoomed out. But I was just highlighting all of those 2019 and early 2020 highs where crude oil bumped its head. And one of the really interesting things, like, I remain structurally very bullish crude, but this entire advance in crude has been pretty systematically moving higher. And the question I have is that, are we going to see crude oil bump its head up along these previous highs? And this is very relevant because later on, we're going to be showing the chart on the break evens and all sorts of other inflation metrics, because what we have is scenarios that crude oil and copper and so many of these resources are major inputs in inflation expectations. And certainly one of the things I would argue that has been spooking the bond market has been the rise in the commodity complex, the way we have been seeing it here. And what will be really interesting to see is whether crude oil bumps its head here and actually does some sort of a correction off of here, because that may take the pressure off of those inflation metrics, and this very oversold bond market may be given a reason to bounce. And I think that's very premature for me to be calling that. But watching what these commodities do up along these highs, I think is something that needs to be high on everyone's priority list.
Well, Patrick, I couldn't agree more, and I love this particular chart and the timescale that you've chosen here, because you see at the very beginning of 2020, in January 2020, and then back in May of 2019, those two highs were about the same level, 65 spot 65, and that's the reason that I'm eyeing that as the next level. Now, the way I see this, that's a pretty darn formidable resistance level, because just look at the chart here. You can see that's where it's topped out for, the last almost 2 years. It's as high as it was able to get. So I do think that some kind of consolidation or pullback or correction or something is in order. But the question in my mind is, what if we break above this pink box that you've got here at some point? And I don't think it would happen instantly just to slice through it. I think there has to be some kind of consolidation because it is a key resistance level. But what happens if we do break out above it? And from a technical perspective, I don't really see much more resistance until around 75, and I'm not sure what comes after that. How would you see it if we do see a breakout above that?
I think that if you wanted something to spook the bond market proper, a crude oil breakout above these highs would do it. And I think that it's not even so much about the impact to the crude oil markets as much as the shockwaves it would send through the intermarket relationships everywhere else. And that could really create some short-term capitulation in the bond markets and other areas if we saw that kind of a break. I mean, I think it's prudent to assume it won't, but if it did, that certainly, I think, think would stir up the intermarkets quite a bit, and so we're approaching some pretty critical levels to watch for sure. But what's interesting is that when we move on to page 11 and show the copper chart, and I mean, I only show copper here, but I mean whether you're talking the grains, whether you're talking about steel and like iron ore prices or any of these other commodities, we continue to see outright bull advances coming right across the entire commodity complex outside of bullion. But what's particularly noteworthy for me for copper is that if I didn't tell you there's a copper chart and I told you this was one of these GameStop style stocks, like it would we're going parabolic on these advances. It's like it's not that I'm not a commodity bull. I'm actually quite bullish commodities. I agree with Julian Brigden and others that we are in the early phases of a sustained long-term bull market. But whenever you see short-term acceleration to the upside this way, it usually leads to some short to intermediate time frame blow off on the upside, which often results in mean reverting corrections. And when I see this type of an acceleration to the upside of copper and seeing some of the other stuff that's happening in the other commodities, at least it's something that makes me pay attention a lot more, because something's got to give. If copper keeps going like this, by the end of next month, it's going to be at $6-7. I mean, is that possible? I don't know. But boy, has copper been a great trade in the last month.
Well, Patrick, I agree with you completely on both crude oil and copper that, boy, they've gone so far so fast, they're overdue for a consolidation, if not an outright correction, a substantial pullback. But you know what? I got a spidey sense feeling about both of them going higher from here, probably after some kind of consolidation or pullback. And maybe that plays out for a few months before we're ready to go higher, but I think they're both going higher before this is over.
Right. And so what is interesting, though, and I want to spend the rest of today's chart deck talking about it, is looking at the interest rate markets. And here on page 12, I have that chart of the 10-year Treasury yield. And one of the things that I've always felt, and we've heard it from other guests as well, I don't think it's so much of an issue that interest rates on the long end of the curve are rising. I think that where all the problems arise is the rate of change of the rise, because it's whether or not something is misbehaving or something breaks in the bond markets. And if the rise in interest rates is happening too rapidly, that is, I think, the potential catalyst for the Fed to actually step in with some sort of a yield curve control. So it's not really about higher interest rate, but the rate of that change. And what's really notable here is that we have seen a very distinct acceleration to the upside of those interest rates. And that, to me, has got to be the thing to watch, because the shockwaves that this is going to potentially send through the rest of the markets is something we can't ignore. And certainly, you know, I mean, is it out of the realm of impossibility for us to go back to the 190 or 2% level on the 10-year yield, again, where we were trading in the 2019 period? I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility. But if we were at 1.9 or 2% next week or 2 weeks from now, I think that that would be a shock that the market is just not ready for.
Well, Patrick, I think that the economic factors that are pushing rates higher could easily take us back to 3%. The thing is, the key question is, what's the level where the Fed says, no, we're not going to let this happen? And a lot of people, myself included, have assumed that there is such a level, that the Fed is going to not allow long rates to back up beyond a certain level. That really is the key question. If you can get that right and figure out how far this thing is allowed to go before the Fed steps in, then I think you've got huge edge over the market. The question is, what's that level? And I'm going to be asking as many of our feature interview guests as I can that exact question. Let's move on to page 13 and the 2s-10s yield curve. Now, remember Charlie McElligott telling us, fear the steepener. Boy, the steepener is getting steeper, isn't it?
Well, that's exactly what's happening. I mean, there is no denying that that 5-year downtrend of the 2s-10s that brought us to an inverted yield curve down in 2019 has definitively broken the other way. I'm actually shocked that we have had this much of a steepening and the markets have yet to really react to it. One way or another, the steepening is underway, and with the Fed having their foot on the front of the curve, really this is all about the back end bear steepener. And we've really seen that accelerate. And this is the one to watch. What's also going to be interesting is watching, and I don't have a chart on it, what starts to happen at the different curves. Like the 530s have started to kind of get heavy. But even the short yield curves, like the twos, fives, it's going to be really interesting. Up till now, the five-year yields have not priced in short-term inflation fears, at least not to the magnitude that they could. And one of the really interesting things to watch is whether or not the five-year yields will start to actually react to this. I mean, I think there was a big jump in the seven-year here on an awful auction. And really, it's starting to trickle in much more to the midterm part of the yield structure. And so it'll be really interesting to see whether we see further shock come in. One thing, though, I think we could, again, see the steepener even kick in further, and we could even get it a little higher. But boy, is this really accelerating. And that's the part that I think is the red flag about all of this. It's not, it's almost like the bond market is spooked. And this is why watching even crude oil is going to be so important, because like you were saying, I mean, a crack above those 2019 highs, if you ever wanted some shock factor to come into the bond markets that could cause like a really violent move, I think crude oil could be the catalyst for that. And I don't necessarily think crude will, but boy, if it did, that would be certainly something that would create that shock, right?
Moving on to page 14. Boy, Patrick, look in that yellow circle at the sudden upturn in real yields on treasuries. Remember, gold investors, that real yields are the enemy of gold. It's increasing real yields that cause the price of gold to go down. And this chart right here tells you everything you need to know about why gold has been so weak in recent weeks. And frankly, I don't think there's any reason to expect gold to turn around until there's a change in the direction of this chart, which, as you can see, it's very steep, straight up right now. The reason for that is because treasury yields are backing up, while inflation, I think, is increasing too, but it's not being recorded yet. And that's what doesn't get shown here. Would you agree, Patrick? Do you think it's a question of the inflation is there but not being recorded? Or do you think that I'm missing it there?
Well, listen, the 10-year real yield and the TIPS market in general have been holding up incredibly, the TIPS have been holding up, and the 10-year treasury yields have been, real yields have been pinned on the bottom end of the range. And while gold has been more or less selling for or consolidating off of its highs for a better part of 6 months, real yields rising, at least on the 10-year time frame, was not where the catalyst was. But there's no denying that there's been a bit of a shock here. And while I'm not opposed to seeing the nominal yields rising to 2% and, like you were even saying, 3%, I'm a seller on the idea that real yields will turn positive. I think financial repression is the name of the game, and negative real yields, I think, are here to stay. And this is why I actually remain bigger picture bullish gold and want to be buying dips. And I think that this type of a jump, even if we get above minus 50 basis points on this, I don't see that this is where the real break is going to happen. And the fact that this is happening and spooking the gold market, maybe when we finally see this kind of calm down, that may actually mark a short-term low in gold. I think it's at least worth watching.
Well, the question you have to ask yourself is there an expectation of inflation increasing, which is what would turn this around? Moving on to page 15. Yep, sure is.
Yeah, those 30-year break-evens and inflation expectations continue to crawl higher. And I feel that, again, the rising commodity complex, and particularly oil, have been major contributors of these higher inflation expectations and the rising 30-year break-evens. And this is why I think it's actually so important to watch whether oil does bump its head. Because I think that when we're seeing these parabolic rises in copper and oil having risen so long in duration, or not in duration, but as long as it has for the last couple months, if we see corrections begin in the commodity complex, that would certainly allow break-evens to ease off of these levels and allow this reflation impulse to potentially backfill. And I think it's all intertwined, right? This is all one big trade. I mean, almost this entire chart book is intertwined about what is the next move in so many of these markets. And just getting a pulse on what's next here is going to be so critical.
Patrick, let's now talk about how to trade this market, because as I mentioned in the market wrap, boy, this is not the kind of market where I want to be just buy and hold stocks for the long term. I think you've really got to think about a lot of volatility and frankly, a lot of tail risks in both directions. Now, I know at Big Picture Trading, you've done a lot of work around rolling calendared straddles as essentially a way to profit if there's a big move in potentially either direction in the market. Are you still employing that strategy, and how does that fit into the market environment that we've been discussing in this chart deck?
That's right, Eric. There's no better time to emphasize the need to complement a portfolio with a long volatility strategy. And I mean, we've heard many of our favorite guests like Chris Cole with his Dragon portfolio, or Mike Green, or Diego Padilla talk about the need for being long volatility. Well, at Big Picture Trading, we had been recently managing a rolling straddle in our tactical portfolio. And I can't think of a more prudent moment in the market cycle than now to have this as a part of a good portfolio mix. So any of our listeners that want to observe us managing the strategy can have a peek behind the curtain with a complimentary free trial of Big Picture Trading.
And of course, information on that is on page 16 of the slide deck or at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's episode. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Abra Plata Resource Corporation, a premier emerging silver and gold exploration company. Ticker ABRA on the TSX Venture Exchange and ABBRF in the United States. Listeners, if you haven't yet taken advantage of a free subscription to our Research Roundup email newsletter, please do so. You can do that by clicking the red button that says Looking for the Downloads on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Patrick, tell them what they're missing in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find a transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Lynn's slide deck in the chart book we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to a Ray Dalio article on stock market bubbles and a link to Harley Bassman's recent piece on seeking treasure with convexity. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distribution. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelt with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.